I'm Hakan Özoğlu, Associate Professor of History, and you are listening to The Riches Documentary Podcast. Welcome to The Riches Documentary Podcast. RICHES, the regional initiative for collecting the histories, experiences, and stories of Central Florida, is an umbrella program housing interdisciplinary public history projects that bring together different departments at the University of Central Florida with profit and nonprofit sectors of the community in order to promote the collection and preservation of region's history. By facilitating research that records and presents the stories of communities, businesses, and institutions in Central Florida, RICHES seeks to provide the region with a deeper sense of its heritage. This series will feature a podcast every 2 weeks, in the middle and at the end of each month, that will explore various aspects of Central Florida history. In today's episode, Hannibal Square, the other side of Winter Park, Florida, Dr. Julian Chambliss and Farlan Livingston explore the ways in which members of the Hannibal Square community have fought to preserve the heritage of this important piece of Central Florida history.
Hi, I'm Jeffrey Crivera, and in today's podcast, Hannibal Square, the Other Side of Winter Park, Florida, we are going to be speaking with Dr. Julian C. Chambliss and Farlan Livingston about this historic African-American community. Dr. Chambliss is an associate professor of history at Rollins College, specializing in 19th and 20th century urban America, African-American history in Florida, race and ethnicity, American planning history, as well as other topics related to urban experience. Born in Hannibal Square, Farlan Livingston has spent most of her life in the community and is the manager of the Hannibal Square Heritage Center. Dr. Chambliss, Mrs. Livingston, thank you for taking the time to speak with us today. Dr. Chambliss, what is it about the story of Hannibal Square that makes it such an important facet of Central Florida's history?
I think one of the things that's really interesting about Hannibal Square is that Hannibal Square is really part of the story of Winter Park, very much married to the story of Winter Park. Winter Park was founded by a couple of guys named Lauren Chase and Oliver Chapman. They were two New Englanders who'd came to Florida for health reasons. It was very common in the period. Late 19th century, 1880s, people really sort of discovered Florida as a destination for vacation. And if you look at some of the literature about Florida, it's this sort of exotic place. And really this idea of Florida as a sort of paradise, a sort of wild frontier, goes all the way back to the settlement period when the French and the Spanish and the British all had colonies here, and it changed hands a lot of times. And of course, the mystical Fountain of Youth is supposed to be in Florida. So there's a lot of sort of popular sentiment about Florida as a place where people can go and see these sort of incredible things from the colonial period. The efforts of guys like Henry Flagler to create a series of resort hotels along the coast really opened the place up to the super wealthy. But very quickly after that, there were a number of entrepreneurs like Chase and Chapman who looked at areas in Central Florida, which was an inhabitable area, unlike other parts of Florida. It's really difficult to get to Florida for much of its history. Get to the coast, because there's plenty of coast. But if you're looking at the interior, it's basically one long, thick bushel of places. But Central Florida is different because you can get there through the St. Johns River. And so if you look at population, if you look at Florida, really for a lot of its period, a lot of its history, people live in places like Miami, you live in Jacksonville, and then you live in Orlando, and you wonder how is that? Well, it's because you can go down the St. Johns River and get to Sanford and Lake Monroe, and then like you can basically get off, and then that's why you have a lot of small towns in the area. Because of the ease of getting there, Chase and Chapman came down in 1881, 1882, decided they're going to buy a bunch of land, and they're going to do agribusiness, and they're going to lay out the town. They lay out the town of what? It's basically Winter Park. And if you look at Central Florida, the names tell you a lot about what the region was. Winter Park, Winter Garden, Winter Haven. A bunch of New Englanders who don't want to live through the cold, create a bunch of towns. So as a result, you know, you have a lot of basically snowbirds. I mean, these are people who may in fact have only been here during summer months, I mean, during the winter months, but then in the summer they would get out of Dodge, because before air conditioning, lots of New Englanders really couldn't handle living in Florida during the summer. So Chase and Chapman decided going to create the town of Winter Park, and they in fact lay out the town with the full intention that the west side of town is going to be for black people, because they recognize that it's going to be a resort town, like it is a leisure town. They also, in a stroke of good luck, a number of benefactors decided they want to place a college, a small liberal arts college called, that will become Rollins College here, and this really anchors the town as well. So they have like the idea they're going to have this town as a sort of like wealthy tourist destination, and they in fact create Seminole Hotel, which is like one of the most opulent hotels in Florida in the 1880s and 1890s. And they lay out the town in a grid, like if you ever see a map of Winter Park, it's designed so if you come in on a train, and of course there's a train line that runs to the heart of town that sort of connects Winter Park to Orlando, which is the major, big major city, not city, but town and area. It's a series of 5-minute walks from the center, from the train station. And so they create the town and lay it out, and they have a black part for the servants who they know they're going to need for both labor in the homes and the hotels, but also in the agribusiness, because like they in fact are assuming that there's going to be orange groves in Winter Park. And in fact, for much of its history, Winter Park is chock full of orange groves. And so they need a workforce, African-American, a perfect workforce. And as a consequence, though, as a rule, they said if you have land, if you're African-American, you buy land, you have to build a house right away, like within a certain period of time. So strangely enough, you have Winter Park sort of plotted out and planned as a town from inception with a black part and a white part, and both parts are chock full of like property owning people, right? And the black people are Republicans. Like, of course they're Republicans. Like, it's post-Civil War, so they're mm-hmm. Republicans. In fact, there are more black permanent year-round residents in Winter Park than there are white permanent year-round residents in Winter Park, which is why they needed the black people to make the what is the community in Winter Park into a town, an official town. They needed the black people to vote. And so early in the town's history, there was a campaign, and Gus Henderson, who was the leading sort of like newspaper publisher, printing guy in Hannibal Square, came out in favor of supporting incorporation of the town. And so the African-American registered voters, who were, again, there were more registered black voters than there were registered white voters, voted in favor of the town, which may allow Winter Park to be a town officially, to be incorporated as a town. And of course, in that first period in the early 1890s, there are black aldermen, Simpson and Israel, who are from Hannibal Square, that serve on the town council. So that really sort of like makes that, those issues make Winter Park very unique. Like, it is developed around the time in the aftermath of the Civil War in the 1880s, where large numbers of people are sort of coming in to the region. Hannibal Square in Eatonville, which is the first incorporated all-black town in the United States, the oldest incorporated all-black town in the United States, have a lot of sort of social connections, because Eatonville, which is, you know, less than 2 miles from Hannibal Square, very famous now as the home of Zora Neale Hurston. She grew up there, and a lot of her fiction is set there. But in fact, if you look at the sort of like social life of African Americans, lots of institutions like the Hungerford School in Eatonville, kids in Hannibal Square, the black kids here, they went to the Hungerford School because that was the only school that they could go to. So there's a lot of connections in terms of the black community throughout the region, because of those issues.
Mrs. Livingston, what are your thoughts on why this community story should be heard?
Well, over a decade ago, I participated in a piece about vanishing communities. And even though Hannibal Square is still alive and well, it is not the community that Afro-Americans once knew and lived in and appreciated. I think it's important that people know who was here, when they got here, and what they did and what they contributed. We are just getting around to telling our story, because we don't want to be painted with this broad brush of being unfit, embracing things that are not of value. You know, we want people to know that we came in 1881. We built our homes, we built our schools, we built our lodges, we had our businesses, we were self-sustaining. We depended upon the work that was provided by the wealthy families in Winter Park. And there was a real special kind of relationship between those families who worked for the wealthy whites. Sometimes generations worked for the same families.
How did the prosperity of Winter Park affect the development and gentrification of Hannibal Square, and what were some of the consequences of this?
I think that it has everything to do with the founding of the town. As I said, the town was founded as Winter Park was founded as a sort of residential, leisure, agribusiness location. But because of that whole planning quirk, all those African Americans, a large number of African Americans came down, they bought plots on the west side, and they actually bought some fairly large chunks of land. And they were very entrepreneurial. They had property, they had an income, many of them worked at the hotel, they worked for wealthy families, and those wealthy families were not year-round residents in a very real sense of the word. So they would have a sort of steady income, they could also cultivate land, they had groves. And it is a period of deep racial segregation, but the population in terms of like the white population isn't really going to be a huge factor in the day-to-day lives of African Americans. I mean, this is one of the things that makes Central Florida very interesting. If you look at a town like Eatonville, which is very close to Maitland, which is a white town, and you look at a town like Hannibal Square, which is technically a part of Winter Park, but Winter Park is a white part and Hannibal Square is a black part. There are definitely economic overlaps, right? So like they interact with each other economically, but socially, you know, it's basically a wide open space. They don't really have to interact with each other. Rapid population growth, especially in Winter Park after the turn of the century, changes this a little bit, but the era of segregation and the sort of like structure of the economy, like these were African Americans that have jobs, they have property, they are very active politically. And this, in fact, is a huge issue in the 1890s. This is why, in fact, Hannibal Square is detached from the city of Winter Park. I mean, when Winter Park was organized as a town, they needed those African Americans to vote in favor of the town being created. But very quickly in the early 1890s, like 1893, 1894, Democrats, the white people, are really fearful of the political power represented by the black voting Republicans. And so they decide to detach the black part of town. So Hannibal Square is no longer part of Winter Park, only to have to reattach it when they want to become the city of Winter Park. In the late 1920s. But the fact of the matter is that if you look at Hannibal Square throughout that period, it was the center of like its own sort of black economy. There were business owners. Like I said, they owned land, they cultivated crops, they had groves where they were growing oranges. And so this was a period where African Americans could do very well for themselves, especially because they had a sort of agrarian economic model that worked well. I mean, oranges and agricultural work, the land was cheap, the water was plentiful. They also had a very strong sort of social system. As I said, education was available. They also had some really strong patronage relationships. I think if you look at some of the families that were really prominent, really successful in Hannibal Square, a lot of those families worked for white families. And as I said, they were snowbirds, so they were here some of the time, but most of the time we're not here. But when they were here, those people worked for them and they got a good wage. When they weren't here, those people, the African Americans, were free to sort of like, you know, capitalize on what other kind of economic opportunity they could, and they did a good job of doing that. And of course, in a very classic sense, segregation helped this, because if you were black, all the sort of like economic activity was sort of trapped within the community a lot of the times. Whatever sort of like economic prosperity that you have, it would have a direct and, you know, sort of ripple effect within the African American community. There was no capital flight, as it were, in that period. Well, I think that one of the things that Winter Park is and Hannibal Square really sort of speak to is that the Florida experience really is kind of typified by Central Florida. I mean, in a lot of ways, North Florida is more southern. It's almost like part of Georgia or Alabama. South Florida is really sort of Latin. You know, Miami is the gateway to Latin America. Central Florida is a sort of hodgepodge, but it's definitely a kind of meeting place for some of the big forces that have been changing the state for a long time. And the African-American experience in Central Florida, I think, is really important, because there is, without question, a big sort of emphasis on autonomy and property ownership and the ability to do. And a lot of this grows from the sort of wide open feel and sort of reality that developed in Florida after the end of the Civil War. I mean, there was a large amount of land that was available for African-Americans to acquire, and indeed did acquire. And there's a large number of small communities of African Americans in Central Florida. Some of them towns and sort of identifiable as towns, but some of them sort of like hamlets that never quite made it to the level of like officially incorporated towns. And then there are, you know, sizable communities of African Americans in established towns like Orlando or Jacksonville, for that matter. And Jacksonville is a perfect example of that. It's a very big town with a very wealthy and very active African-American population. But Orlando also had that. I mean, Orlando had a black chamber of commerce. Orlando had like lots of black businesses. And places like Eatonville and Hannibal Square really sort of like spoke to the ability of African-Americans to do things. And it's curious at some level, because if you look at some of the key figures that are very active in Central Florida, issues like civil rights and issues like economic development are really different in Central Florida as opposed to other parts of the South, because you have a large number of African Americans that are really active, you know, like Harry T. Moore, very active in getting people involved in the vote. And Moore's approach is very sort of grassroots. These are our legal rights. We're just going to exercise them. Not radical in the sense of like radical politics, more like these are sort of like commonly held American democratic rights, and we're not going to be denied them. And that kind of message, I think, really resonated in Central Florida because of this experience of people sort of like having set up these communities, having sort of like worked and built things and been successful because of the relatively small population, and also because of the wide open space. I mean, it's kind of like the frontier, and the frontier allows people to sort of create the world that they want. And that really is sort of like, I think, a unifying theme for the Florida experience. And that's always something I think students and scholars and even people today, I mean, this is a really sort of common assertion, but it's usually reserved purely for the white people, like the Florida cracker phenomenon, like all these independent yeoman farmers that really sort of like made Florida. But the Florida cracker phenomenon isn't really just a white experience. It's the experience of almost everyone in Florida. It is a place where you have to sort of come and make yourself succeed. And the lessons learned from that process really carry over for years and years and generations and generations. And I think that's a really important thing to recognize.
I'm talking about people coming together and just knowing one another without prejudging. You know, I get so many people coming to visit here at the center, and the first thing you want to tell me are all the negative stories that you read about in the paper. You know, and that's not what this community was all about.
We'd like to thank our guests, Dr. Chambliss and Mrs. Livingston, for joining our discussion. If you'd like to learn more about this historic community, the Hannibal Square Heritage Center is located at 642 West New England Avenue, Winter Park, Florida, 32789. I'm Jeffrey Crivera. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for listening to the Riches Documentary Podcast. Feel free to contact us with any questions or comments on the program that you just heard. Please join us for the next episode, Huntoon Island State Park.